Welcome to the 20th episode of Season 3 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Monday the 8th of November 2010, and in this episode we're going to interview Anna Nelson and discuss what makes you ditch software. We will of course cover all the latest news, events, all a bit about Ubuntu command line love, and go over your feedback. I'm Tony, and with me this week there's, well, it's a full house again, five of us crammed in here. It's getting hotter and hotter by the minute.
You should take that jumper off.
I should take that nice lovely jumper. Leave me alone. Alan, hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm all right, thank you.
Really?
Yes.
Good. Okay, what have you been
up
to?
Are we recording this at double speed or something?
It's upbeat.
It's so when you listen back to it on your phone.
I wouldn't do that. I'd listen to myself. Hello.
So, hello, what have you been doing?
Recording some more screencasts.
Some Ucasts?
Yes, I call them Ucasts to kind of separate them from being Ubuntu, because I might do... like Unity, maybe. Ooh. Or might do KDE ones, maybe.
Yeah, list smart self.
Kick
Here's how you delete KDE, which is something we already could talk about in one of our segments today.
Yes, absolutely.
Cool. Are they going all right?
Yeah, yeah. I've nailed down the process so that I plug the microphone in, record, start talking, stop, encode it, upload it, done. I don't do any editing. There's no music, right. There's no header and footer or anything like that. It's just record it, go.
We should try that.
Yeah.
We'll never catch on.
So what have you done? What have you done them on?
I've done a few just intros, like, you know, navigate around the desktop, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And update manager, I put one out today, and I've got a plan to do loads and loads and loads, and I've got people editing an Etherpad document, adding ideas for stuff, and I got a load of ideas from Stuart Langridge about Ubuntu One, funnily enough.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. You should do screencasts about all of these things.
Right.
I was like, oh, great, thanks. No, really, thanks.
And so, you can see those at ucasts.tv, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Excellent.
And you can subscribe them in, you know, your feed reader or whatever.
Oh, cool.
Also available on iTunes.
And Google Reader. Yes. Simon.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
We've run back down to single speed.
It's Monday. No, I'm fine.
Good.
Busy
good.
Couple of weeks. Yeah. I've been playing with my Joggler again.
Hey.
Ovi tweeted about a new image available.
Oh, right.
Was it on Saturday, the weekend?
Yes, and it's very recent.
I fragged mine, actually trying to upgrade it. And, yeah, my original image. And I thought, put it in the corner over there and just left it. And then Popey tweeted about this new Maverick image. Oh, go on then. And it was just so easy. Download the image, DD it onto your USB stick, go, works, brilliant.
That's not an official image, it's an Ubuntu image for the Joggler.
It's a community guy who's...
Jules Wills is the guy who's done it.
With the Unity UI?
No.
Win.
Oh.
That's kind of weird.
Well, Unity doesn't work. It's the netbook edition, but Unity doesn't work.
You can install the old netbook launcher on it, which is what I did.
That might be worth doing. Because the problem with Unity is it needs 3D and the drive, video driver, blah, 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 you know.
So what are the big differences in this new image? Why is it so great?
Because it works.
And it has Unity on it.
And it has a nice keyboard.
Yeah. It's got all the latest crap.
Yeah, new on-screen keyboard.
It's
really good.
There's more letters than the old one.
It's nicer. You can see through it to whatever you're meant to be typing into, whereas with the other one you couldn't. It's quite useful. The only issue is, actually, I've set it up as a bedside sad loser terminal. So that,
waking from the middle of the night.
That's right.
Sleep. I can watch it installing on other computers. Now, I wanted to use it as an alarm clock. And there aren't any decent alarm clocks.
Conventional alarm clocks are just rubbish.
Well, they wake up all the time.
Well, they only use batteries, and I need to have a computer on it all the time.
Of course.
Just to add to my power consumption.
Yeah.
So I wanted to use it as an alarm clock. Right. And there aren't any decent alarm clocks out there that you can use in sort of bed mode. Oh my god, I'm awake, stamp on the alarm button.
And does the Joggler make for a decent alarm clock?
Yeah, it does actually. It would make a decent alarm clock if there was a decent alarm clock app.
Oh, well, quickly.
Right.
Python,
we should talk about this later on in another sec. But it's a bit fiddly. The touchscreen is really, really good, but you need to have sort of pencil-sized fingers to get it to work.
But really, really long.
With a rubber on the
end. That's right.
Not fat sausage fingers.
So it does work. It just needs a little bit of work to make it work better, or some accessibility options, which we might be able to talk about on another show, hopefully.
Okay.
What else have I done? I've been dabbling in the black arts of IP tables and failing miserably. And
welcome to everyone.
Oh, God.
UFW.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is that I'm trying to stop my asterisks server getting hammered by bots, which is why I'm dabbling in IP tables. Failed to ban is meant to work with IP tables, and mine isn't, so that's why I'm dabbling in. Ugh, not winning. Anyway, this is turning into the Simon's show, so we're back over to you, Tony.
So, Laura.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Make it quick.
Yeah, very quickly. What have you been doing?
Okay, well, I can make it even quicker by stealing your what you've been doing.
Right, okay.
We both went up to see Anna Nelson in London at the weekend, and I got to talk geek with her.
Excellent.
She does know how to talk geek.
She does, and so I talked geek with her for a while, and Tony seemed a bit...
Tony took his camera and took pictures of stools and things.
Yes.
Yeah, in a market, just to clarify. Just to clarify what I was taking the photos of.
Yeah.
Okay, that's both of us. Two birds with one stone.
It was a bit.
But there we go. And Mark is here again. I mean, really, we should ask him to leave the house in between recordings, I think. He's
still in my
here,
seat.
But it's cold out there.
The mistake was telling him where I live, I think. But he's back again.
I haven't made that mistake. Oh, hang on. Yes, I have.
Yes.
Hello, Mark.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm good.
What have you been up to?
I've been playing games.
Okay. On Linux?
On Linux.
Wow.
I found a website called
GOG.com,
which stands for Good Old Games.
Okay.
And they have all the games that came out when I was about 12.
-3.
Last year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which were, you know, sort of Windows 98 sort of games.
Call of Duty.
Which play brilliantly on
about 8.
Wine and Crossover.
Right, okay.
And they're about between about £4 and about £10 each. So I've been playing the original Fallout for most of this week.
So it's like the proper game. It's not like some dodgy...
No, this is properly... Rip-off. They've licensed them from the original people and like packaged them all up, got them so they run on modern systems. They're not packaged to run on Wine, but they work so far, the ones I've used.
So they package them for Windows, but you can run them under Wine on Linux.
Oh, okay. I just installed it using the Crossover installer as an unsupported application.
Right.
And, lots of fun.
Excellent. And sound works. And
sound works.
Acceleration or if you need it.
Yeah.
Wow. How good is that?
Tony, not a massive game player.
I'm not a massive game player.
Exhausted all his questions there.
I have played more advanced games than that on Crossover successfully before. So I wasn't that surprised. Mm. I was just thought it was quite fun to find all these old games that I could get reasonably easily.
Yeah, anybody got anything that they'd like to try out from the old gaming days?
I used to like the old Commander Keen, really old, DOS-based, like 2D platform type games.
They don't have that old one, so they've got a few, they've got all the Space Quest and King's Quest.
Oh. And of course, if you buy those, you can use those with the Scum VM on just about any platform.
And they've got, Beneath the Steel Sky, because that's free. You get that free as soon as you sign up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Ooh. Oh.
There you go.
I can see me spending some more money on games.
GOG.com, when you're not listening to Spotify.
Yes.
Right, well, that's definitely the intro over and done with.
Sounds like a feisty show, eh?
Last year at Osbar Camp, we interviewed Anna Nelson about her statistical analysis of software. Try saying that.
It's easy for you to say.
And this year at Osbar Camp, we did the same thing. We sat down, Alan and I, and interviewed Anna about her latest project called Dexy. And here's the interview.
One of the most mind-boggling interviews I've ever done was this time last year at Osbar Camp. And now I'm back here at Osbar Camp. Alan is now with me again. And Anna's here. And Anna boggled us last time. You're going to boggle us again. What are you talking about this year?
This year I'm talking about my new project called Dexy, which is a document automation project that's sort of... I've been interested in this area for several years, and I've sort of found various ways of doing this, and Dexy is the project that finally pulls them all together into one package.
Because last year you were talking about automating documentation through Excel spreadsheets and things.
I think last year I was working quite a lot within a framework called Webby, which was generating my text pages, and I was doing things within that framework. And basically there were a few restrictions there in terms of what I could do, and it wasn't quite the full solution that I was looking for. So basically I've taken a lot of things I've learned from using Webby and using a lot of other frameworks and put them all into my new project.
Okay, so what is Dexy? How does it work?
So Dexy is sort of a make tool. It's a build tool for automated documents, and it is going to take a lot of different sources and pull them together and compile your documents with lots of different inputs. So at the moment, there's a very simple command line interface which will just run all the documents in a certain directory and pull them together for you.
Okay, so is it a developer's tool?
At the moment, it's probably more suitable for people who are pretty experienced, maybe have some Python experience, but are quite confident on the command line. The hope is that in the long term, it won't be limited to just that set of people who are working on a web server and some other ways of accessing it. For the moment, it's a command line tool, and anyone who's pretty happy with the command line should have no trouble using Dexy.
What's the goal of this? Is it just to bring together all the documentation that's in disparate places, or is it to improve documentation, or what does Dexy give us?
What Dexy gives you is a way of making it easier to write and to maintain documentation. And the hope is that that's an easier process to reduce the friction of writing good documentation. The hope is that there will be more good documentation. And by taking a literate approach, so with Dexy, you actually incorporate live source code into your documents and the output of running live source code into your documents. So what that means is you're not going to have typos in your documents. You're going to actually have real source code rather than a lot of people will write documentation and try to come up with an example as they're writing, but they won't have run that example. It'll be what they think is going to work, but they might not have actually tested it. Or if they did test it, they won't always test it every time they create the documentation. When you take obviously literate documentation is a very old idea, but it's a very good idea. And I think with Dexy, we're just trying to make that easy to use with modern tools and to make that as flexible and as powerful as it can be.
How does it grab chunks of code from your existing code base that you've already written? How does it know which bits you want to pull out and put in your document?
Well, you're gonna write a little very nice configuration file to tell it where to look for things. And one option is to kind of write example scripts within the directory you're working in, and those might call functions from your library. But you can also reference code in your library in situ by just putting the full path to that. There's a few different systems we're working on for actually being able to pull out specific chunks of code. At the moment, what you do is you're going to just put little comments that are very unobtrusive in your code to delimit small sections of code, and then you can just talk about one section of your code at a time. And that makes it very easy to have a very big document but only pull out a few sections at a time that are the ones you want to talk about. But your full document, your full source code is still there, so you can still run that and make sure that it works and look at the output from that.
And when you say run the code, actually when you go to run Dexy, it goes off and compiles and or, if required, runs your code and then takes the actual output from your command and pipes that into your document.
That's exactly what Dexy does, yes. It will run your code through whatever interpreter or whatever system you want it to run through, and it'll actually take the live output. And that's what makes it so fast and productive for people, because you just have to write source code in a source file and pull that through different things and actually get the output. And it also means you're going to have correct documentation because it's actually the live output.
One of the things that large projects often have is a documentation team and then a development team and a test team. Is this a way of making the developer the documenter as well?
It could be, or what it could do is make it easier for, I mean, I suppose it's not really, I don't think it would really impose a particular structure on you. It's going to make it easier for whoever is writing the documentation to write the documentation, whether that's a specialized team that does it or whether it's the developers themselves. And I don't think it's going to impose any sort of a structure on that. I would certainly like to get to the point where developers see documenting as a part of what they do instead, just as testing now is, I think, in a lot of places seen as part of what developers do. I think that it's good for developers to write their own documentation because it gives them a type of feedback on the code that they've written that actually does what the documentation says it does. And with Dexy, you can actually demonstrate that it does what you say it's going to do because you're running it right there. But certainly, I would hope it would, even if someone's in a separate documentation team, I would certainly hope this would be beneficial to them just as well.
You mentioned Python, but is this limited to Python applications, or could it... And you mentioned that it's highly configurable. Is this something that I could take my C program, my Java program, or whatever code I have and just add a few tags, create a config file, create some filters, and then I'm done? Is that all I need?
Basically, yes. I mean, this is it happens to be written in Python, but it by no means is limited to Python. And I've personally used it for C and Java and Ruby and Python and R and quite a lot. And it's because of the way it's structured, it's very easy to add new support for new languages or new tools, even proprietary software tools. There's nothing stopping you if it has a command line interface or if it's scriptable. You can write a Dexy filter for it very easily and pull it in. So it's especially good if you want to you want to incorporate multiple languages in one document. For example, I would write simulations maybe in Python or in another language or in Java, and then I would do statistical analysis and graphs using R. And one of the nice things about DEXY is I can use the same tool and pull all those together. So you can have as many different languages as you want and as many different applications as you want producing output in a single document. So yes, it's very open that way in terms of what languages you can use it for.
And is it mostly focused on command line applications at the moment, or and scripts and so on, or do you envisage a point when it can take screenshots or multiple screenshots or video or whatever else to document your project?
In principle, anything that is scriptable could be run with DEXY, because it can run any script. So if your script is to open up a GUI and take screenshots, or if your script is to open up a web page and interact with a web application, maybe using water or something like that, that should certainly be possible. And I'll actually be doing that with one of my own projects very soon. But it's easiest, certainly, and it's most naturally lends itself to command line tools, and that's where the focus of development has been up to now. And probably the people who are using command line tools are going to be the ones who most readily are going to learn DEXY at this stage and put it to use. I would hope in the long term it would be beneficial for GUI tools. I think probably at the moment the sweet spot is certainly with command line tools and getting output from those.
And in an example of total meta-ness, the documentation you handed out for the talk today is an example of a DEXY project that includes its own source code at the end of it. This is the sort of self-updating, self-referential type project where it sort of really comes into its own.
Yes, I mean, that's quite a fun thing I get to do with DEXY is for today, I created just a very simple LaTeX document that pulled together examples from a few different languages and syntax side of them, and I was able to actually run the LaTeX source of that through a syntax highlighter and actually include that within the document that I handed out. So it is quite nice that you can do self-documenting that way and actually show how, and one of the things that actually kind of shows quite nicely is how a very small very minimal source code can actually turn into quite a nice complex document once you've all actually pulled the snippets into it and it's compiled with graphs and everything.
And once you've created this, you can just rerun DEXY maybe overnight once developers have committed their code changes, and in theory the documentation gets updated overnight, or you know, even if it's part of the build process, they build their code and then update the documentation, or are you expecting it to all just be part of the build process or something separate?
I'd certainly think it makes sense to work it into your build process. I think everyone has maybe slightly different workflow around maybe using commit hooks with your version control system or an automated build system. I think DEXY will fit quite nicely into whatever system you want to use. As far as running it overnight, that's certainly an option, but DEXY has a very good caching system built into it where components only need to be updated when their source has actually changed, and it's quite good at recognizing when something needs to be updated because you've changed the source code or maybe you've changed a dependency further down the line that something is input. So you could run it overnight, certainly. You could also just run it incrementally because it's only going to update what's actually been changed. But certainly it would be a wonderful thing to have as part of your build process because it means your documentation is always going to be right up to date, which is very important for a lot of projects.
Would that have a negative impact on the build process? Because obviously a developer, one of the things they don't want to be doing is tapping their fingers waiting for the compile process to finish. And if the dependency they're waiting on is in fact the documentation, they're probably less interested in that and more interested in getting a built executable at the end of it that they can test. So is it something you would see as being done much later on after, you know, the developer has committed a load rather than during the build process?
I suppose that would depend on the project. I mean, one thing I really like about using DEXY myself in real time on my own projects is that I get to see a kind of a tangible output from what I commit straight away. So I think it might even work the other way, where developers would look forward to seeing the documentation because they get to see their work in kind of lights, as it were. They get to see this nice documentation that's showing the code they've just committed. I think that might be quite positive reinforcement and quite nice for people. With the caching system, really, you're not probably not going to have a huge weight. Obviously, if it got to the point where it was affecting people's workflow, then you know you might do that in a post-commit hook, or you might do that overnight. One thing that I find quite useful about Dexy is that, especially when you're writing a document where you want to have that document kind of updated in real time, you can sort of be writing about your code, and you can refresh the document in almost real enough time to actually have it be part of your thought process, because you're writing a few paragraphs of text, and then you want to pull in your source code or pull in the results of running that code. The thing with Dexy, because it's only going to update as you need to update, you can actually almost view your document being built in real time, to the point it's almost fast enough where it's kind of a part of your natural flow and a part of your natural thought process, and that is very, very beneficial.
Yeah, I mean, if you're only changing a small part of code on each commit, you'll only have a small change to the documentation, hopefully, as a result. Therefore, little and often is better than once in a big chunk.
Absolutely. And with the caching system, if you have 50 code examples and they've all been highlighted and run, and you only change the source code for one, the rest of those examples are going to be in the cache already. So actually compiling the final document is going to be very quick, because you've got most of the work done already.
You mentioned during the talk something about a web service interface to Dexy. Can you tell me a bit more about what that's for and how that works?
Yeah, so basically usually when you're composing documents, you're going to have a kind of a directory structure, and you're going to write your documents in directories, maybe organize them into subdirectories, and that lends itself really nicely to browsing the output in using just a simple web interface. So I've got a pretty good prototype using Mongrel 2, which is a really nice web server that just lets you run things through messaging queues, and it works really, really smoothly with Dexy to just build files as you need them. And basically, as you browse a directory, it will look for cached files. If it finds them, it will serve them, and if it doesn't, it will run Dexy on that directory and generate the files and then serve them to you. And it's quick enough that even when obviously if you've got a very slow process, you're going to notice that. But if you just have a small number of changes, the updates are usually going to be quite fast. So you can use this to actually work in real time and have your files updated as you browse the directory. And you can also use it, obviously, as just an interface to view static files that have already been generated.
Have you run Dexy against any, what you would consider, I know everyone has a different perception of what is a large project, but have you run Dexy against any, you know, massive code bases and built up, you know, huge documentation trees with it?
I have one in mind, which is going to be my PhD thesis. I'm going to revisit that, which it's been a few years now since I finished that, so I think I can stand to face up to that again. That was sort of the project that inspired me to really have a good process for this, because I had that automated to a degree, but not really to the point where I could delete everything and start from scratch and build everything up. So I do have that in mind. I probably haven't run it on any huge YouTube projects as yet, but I will be doing so over the next couple of weeks, because I'm going to be revisiting this project, which involved very large Java simulations, piping out huge amounts of data, and then having to process the results of that data and incorporate that into a document. And that was really the point where what I wanted there was to be able to change the parameter specification for the simulation, and then run the simulation again, and then have the entire document updated. And I think finally I was able to do that to a degree with sort of mixing and matching various tools at the time, but hopefully now with Dexy I'm at the point where I will be able to change the parameters. So, let's see what the outcome is with alpha equals 0.5 instead of 0.6, run everything again, and have my PDF at the end of it.
And is it just yourself working on Dexy, or have you got a community around it? What's the awareness like so far? You've got 14 followers on Twitter, I noticed just now. I think I was number 14. So, how's that built up?
At the moment, it's just me. I've got a few people who are giving me very good feedback on it, who are starting to use it and give me very good feedback on it. Obviously, at this point, I'm looking for people to try it out and test it and let me know how it works for them and what could be better. And then I'll be hoping, once it's to the point where very easy for people to get started, then I'll be doing my best to push it out to a larger community through promoting it through screencasts and making it easy for people to use it and try it out.
So how can people try it out now if they want to?
At the moment, you can come to the website. We have a blog, which is at blog.dexy.it. You can also follow Dexyit on Twitter, and that will give you basically everything you need to know. The source code is on Bitbucket at the moment, so if you look for my name, Anna Nelson, on Bitbucket, or search for Dexy on Bitbucket, you should find it there with examples, and the blog source code's there as well.
Okay, and one final question. Why Dexy?
Well, okay. It's I suppose a nice short name. Makes a nice command line tool. It was. I'm thinking of. It's the sort of thing that you can run on a very large project and have it run overnight. So I suppose the whole Dexys Midnight Runners was sort of in my head at the time, and it also works quite well as the slogan for Dexy is "Make Docs Sexy," because it's a make tool for documentation, and so it's kind of a sexy documentation tool. So Dexy.
That's the sort of thing we need more of. In the open source community. Sexy tools.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to us.
Thank you, my pleasure.
And it's time for the news.
Adventure Game Studio, a system for creating point-and-click adventure games, has been open-sourced. Written on top of the .NET framework, this presents a potential for a mono port to run on Linux systems.
Interesting.
I don't think it has been ported yet. I think someone's had a go at it.
Oh, right, okay.
I don't think it's been done. I think there's some bits of it that are a bit difficult to do. I think it might use WinForms, which we don't do on
mono. It doesn't do on mono. So, point-and-click adventure games. What do you mean by that? Like Monkey Island and things like that?
Yeah. So, basically, you get an image on the screen. Yeah, Tony with his special, gaming blank look, which is not a gaming blank look through playing too many games. It's a gaming blank look through not knowing anything about games.
Okay.
Yeah, games where you, rather than type go north, like the really old games, you click, like, up.
Like Google Street View.
Yes. Right. Okay. Google fish. Street View, yes.
Isn't, give fish to troll.
Isn't that just adventure games now?
Well, no. We'll get feedback about this. Interactive fiction, I think they're really called, collectively.
Oh, the whole kind of Spock and...
What?
Kirk there, stuff.
No,
that's
no.
Slash.
No, Slash Fiction.
Okay. Oh, boy.
No, but I mean, as opposed...
It's interactive.
Yeah, well, yeah. The point and click bit seems redundant, that's what I meant.
Why is that?
Because you just said it's been 20 years since they went point and click.
Oh, I see.
To me, they're all point and click.
No, but people still make... There's a competition every year, called the IF Comp. Every year, people make interactive fiction. Some of it point and click, some of it text-based, yeah. Yeah, it's going back to Mark's good old games thing, people still make them now. Yes. I know.
Last one I played was Hitchhiker.
Welcome to the Ubuntu Game Show.
Microsoft has been pushing HTML5 technologies for media streaming and rich web content after having chosen HTML over Silverlight as the platform for ESPN's Xbox 360 application. While maintaining that Silverlight is the platform for Windows Phone 7 development, Bob Muglia?
That'll do.
Of Microsoft cited HTML5 as the only true cross-platform solution. Meanwhile, Steve Ballmer, Microsoft's CEO, attempted to quell uproar from the Silverlight developers with a blog post reinforcing Microsoft's commitment to the technology as a platform to do the things HTML can't in a way that's easier for developers to use.
Yeah, there are lots of comments on various blog posts and news articles about the fact that Microsoft, quote, were killing Silverlight, unquote. From developers saying, I've staked my career on this and I'm going to sue you for loss of earnings.
Unlucky.
Yeah, exactly. You use proprietary software. What do you expect?
But
if you'd used Python and you only learnt Python version 1 and you wanted to use Python version 1 for the rest of your career, you could do.
Yeah. Yes.
So you can't do that with proprietary stuff.
In additional news, today Steve Ballmer's cashed in $1.3 billion worth of Microsoft shares. Apparently to cover his year-end tax commitments or something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not wondering whether the writing's on the wall there.
Who knows?
Indications that IE9's HTML5 performance is better than other browsers are greatly exaggerated, it says here in this news article.
Mark might know what it means.
Yes, Mark. I don't know. This is a bit of a wishy-washy sort of claim and possibly not claim, depending on what article you're reading. Basically, Microsoft have submitted some tests to W3C, which allow you to test if your browser is compatible with HTML5. But there's only about 250 tests in total when they need like thousands and thousands of tests to even begin to say anything is compatible with it.
Right.
And because Microsoft submitted the tests, obviously IE9 does the best so far.
Right.
But that doesn't say anything because, you know, it's like two times nothing is still nothing. If there's only 100 tests to test on, then it's not really saying anything that your browser can pass them all.
Right.
I read an article from some guy who's a bit of a Microsoft reporter, and he was poo-pooing the fact that what Mark just said about not being enough tests and saying all the Microsoft haters are pointing this out, and that's the reason. Yeah, that's the only reason why we're pointing it out, not because actually it's true.
Who'd have thought it?
Yes.
Right. Google is suing the US government for mandating Microsoft software. Google has launched a complaint against the US government's Department of the Interior, claiming that they didn't receive fair consideration as a solution for the department's communication platform. The complaint states that the DOI's... I presume that's DOI?
Yep.
The complaint states that the DOI's request for quotations specified that only Microsoft products, specific Microsoft products, would be considered, which Google claims is in violation of the US Competition and Contracting Act.
Yeah, there's that. If you read the full complaint, Google obviously spent a lot of time talking to the DOI about exactly what they're after in this software and how Google Apps might be able to meet it. And then they've gone away and written a spec and produced this spec, which is entirely you must use Microsoft, this particular business version of the enterprise suite of some Microsoft product, rather. It's a bit crazy. Yeah, and they pretended they hadn't released the spec and hadn't been running a pilot all the time behind the scenes, apparently, allegedly.
But what are they going to get out of it, I wonder, apart from a bundle of money, and Google really don't need the money?
They might not happen. It might not happen again next time. And the next department that's putting out some sort of contract might behave a bit better, assuming that they have actually done what they are being accused of.
Allegedly.
Exactly.
Somebody who might want to go on holiday to the US at some point in the future.
Oracle has raised the price of MySQL support packages. While previous packages provided by Sun ranged from $599 to $5,000, the new pricing structure starts at $2,000 and goes up to $10,000. While this gives teeth to the worries over Oracle's continuing support for MySQL as an open source product, it also gives a gap in the market for lower price support contracts from companies like recent startup SkySQL.
I like SkySQL.
Sounds very Murdoch.
I hadn't thought of that. I think a lot of these SkySQL staffers are ex-MySQL/Sun people who have left. So they're making a big thing of you can get support from the same guys.
There were some worries that Oracle were making it harder for you to use some of the features of MySQL, like the InnoDB stuff, but it seems that's not actually the case. Yes.
Yeah, they're still doing the completely open source version, which has got all that stuff in. However, if you want to buy the get the free community proprietary version, you don't get some of the stuff that's in the open source version.
I've never understood why you'd need something other than the free version anyway.
Companies, they like someone that they can poke if it goes wrong. Someone to sue.
No, support, I understand, but I mean, features of MySQL, I've never found.
No, when they break. The companies want to be able to go, it's your fault. We pay for that product.
Yes, no,
stand
okay.
by for
I see
good
point,
suit.
Actually.
Hotmail has announced it will be moving to use encrypted SSL connections throughout its webmail service, while Facebook has already said they'll be addressing the issue in coming months. These announcements come after the release of the FireSheep tool, which allows malicious users to take control of other users' accounts on open Wi-Fi networks.
Brilliant.
That's interesting, isn't it?
That's great. I must exactly what I said on the last show.
Gmail's been... SSL forever, as far as I know. Although it wasn't by default, you log on with SSL like all the others, and then it's HTTP after that. But there was a Firefox extension I've been using for years, which defaults on SSL. And if you use Gmail for domains, the pay-for version, it's always SSL.
You can get a Firefox extension which does that for Facebook and Twitter and other things.
Oh,
as well,
really?
Called HTTPS Everywhere. I think it's made by the EFF.
Ah, handy.
So this was an exploit where people could, even if you authenticated over an SSL page, the cookie was transmitted in plain, unencrypted transmission, and you could grab that cookie and pretend to be the person who authenticated with that cookie.
Except it did all the grabbing and the spoofing for you.
Right.
So you didn't have to use Wireshark or something to do it. You just clicked a button and it did it.
Right.
You were there.
So you could log into people's Facebooks or
Amazon, I think, was the most concerning one, because then you could spend all their money. Microsoft has expressed disapproval at the $1,000 bounty put up by open source electronics advocate Adfruit Industries for the creation of an open source drivers allowing the Xbox Kinect peripheral to be used on other platforms. Microsoft said that they built in numerous hardware and software safeguards designed to reduce the chances of product tampering and will continue to work closely with law enforcement and product safety groups to keep Kinect tamper resistant. Adfruit responded to the statement by raising the bounty to $2,000.
Yeah, that's a game they could lose. One-upmanship with Microsoft. At some point, they'll run out of money.
Huh. One of the, One of the problems with this kind of thing is that this all happens anyway underneath the covers. There's already, you know, people trying to hack these devices, whatever they are, the, you know, PlayStation 1. The Wii controllers, very quickly, people discovered they were Bluetooth and you can use those. People are going to do this, whether you put up that reward or not. And really, putting up that reward just draws attention to it, draws Microsoft's attention to the fact that people are trying to reverse engineer this stuff. And the people who are trying to reverse engineer this stuff probably wouldn't go for it $1,000 or even $2,000 because it takes a fair amount of time and fairly complex equipment to do it. So I don't know whether the reward or bounty or whatever is actually just a bit of publicity for the company themselves.
Yeah, maybe.
Because they've got in the news out of it.
That's a fair point.
Do you think Nintendo lost out at all by people hacking the Wiimotes? I think they probably sold more Wiimotes.
I don't think for the remotes, no. I mean, people hacked the Wii so that you can play, in inverted commas, backed up games, you know, on a Wii. They lose more out of that. I don't think they lose anything out of people hacking the remotes, because the fact is people go out and buy remotes to play with them, and they're 15 quid a pop and they're a piece of plastic with two batteries in it.
And that's the end of the news. And now time for some command line love. Right, go on then. Here's a handy tip I've been using recently to run multiple Firefox windows with separate sessions, which means you can log into the same site as lots of different people, which is handy if you're a web developer doing lots of permissions testing. Not if you're using FireSheep to steal people's details. And how you do it is, first of all, you run Firefox with the argument profile manager, which is all one word with a capital B and a capital M, and then --no-remote as the second argument, and that will open the little profile manager window where you can set up different separate profiles which will store their cookies and session details separately on your machine. And then for each one of those which you want a window for, you run Firefox -P and then the profile name and then --no-remote again, and it'll open the window for that profile. So you can have, say, one called profile 1, 2, profile 3, just run that for each one of those. And you get separate ones.
So you could have like one profile for like the administrator of a site and another profile for a demo user of a site.
Exactly.
And they'd have separate cookies and they'd have separate authentication on the site and stuff.
Or one of your Gmail accounts and another of your Gmail accounts.
Do you know what? I've been such an idiot. I knew this feature was there, but I've been using different browsers. Like I'll log into Gmail once in Chrome and then once in Firefox because they're separate and I want to log in to two different email accounts, like our UUPC email account on one and my own on another, and I could just do this.
Presumably you could do something similar with the incognito or private browsing modes on those browsers, because they're separate, so if you started a couple of windows
around, forget everything though. If you want to test going back as a user that's already been to the site, you can't do that with incognito.
Fair enough.
The other nice thing about this is you could set all your preferences, so you could have like a different skin on each one, so when you alt and tab between them, you know which one's which. You could colour them differently. That's really cool. I like that. That's a good one. That. And even better, it's cross-platform, isn't it? Yes. So if you're at work on Windows and you could have multiple Firefox. Oh, I'll shut up now.
No, that's fine. Can you run Firefox from the command line on Windows?
Yes.
Yeah, Firefox.exe instead of just Firefox, but it should do the same thing. One of the things we've been thinking about recently is what makes you ditch a piece of software and why should you do it? What are the right criteria? There was a little bit of a debate on Twitter earlier in the evening about this. Alan, you were suggesting that people don't approach this in the right way. They seem to ditch stuff too easily.
Well, it's came about because I started filing a bunch of bugs in Gwibber. I've got a PC at home that's a fairly standard install.
Yep.
And because I use mostly standard software on Ubuntu that comes with it, I fired up Gwibber and I noticed a few little things. I thought, right, I'm going to file these bugs. And I recorded a bunch of screencasts so that the developers could see the problem, and you can't dismiss it as, well, I don't know what that is. It isn't happening here. And I posted about five of them. And a few people, when I posted these on Twitter, replied, oh, that's why I got rid of Gwibber. And I switched to Pino or
I was
Shop
one
Cop,
of these people, by the way.
And I just wondered, well, why don't more people file bugs or hopefully get stuff fixed rather than just dumping it? I think dumping's too easy.
Are these bugs kind of like showstoppers? Are they stopping you use the application, or are they minor kind of?
No, one of them was like you scroll to the bottom of the list of your stream and the tweets that are at the top of your stream appear at the bottom of your stream. Now, how often do I go to the very bottom of my stream? Not very often.
Right.
So it's something, it's a UI bug, but you don't see it very often.
Okay, so Mark, you said you dropped Wibber for spurious bugs. What was the reason for that?
Well, for instance, like one of them, it wouldn't, if you did a search in Wibber, or multiple searches, it would open a little button on the side for each search. And then if you closed as many as you could, it always kept one of them open for some reason. Then when you, I think it was when you closed Wibber and opened it again, or whether you, when you minimized it and came back, rather than going to your timeline, it went to search. And I got annoyed with that. Okay. And so I thought, well, I know of another Twitter client which doesn't have that problem. Mm. So I'll switch to that Twitter client.
Did you file bugs as well?
No, because I thought, well, there's one that already works which doesn't have these bugs, so I'll use that.
So, okay, Alan's nodding.
Well, this also came about because I was chatting to a guy who makes a podcast, This Week in Linux, and he reports on Ubuntu News, and I asked him about Ubuntu, and he says, no, he runs Arch Linux. And I said something about, why do you run Arch Linux? Or I know he used to run Ubuntu. And he said, I just switched because there were bugs and, you know, I just didn't like them. And not that he doesn't like Ubuntu, but there were bugs. And he wanted to switch to something that didn't have those bugs.
Yeah,
it has other bugs, but just not those bugs.
And we both know from our experience in the log of having helped people set up a distribution, probably typically Ubuntu, but you know, not necessarily, and spent some time getting it right, and then the user has encountered a bug and blatted it all and replaced it with a different distro on the hope that this one bug that they might have encountered with a piece of software is fixed in this other distro, which it may be, but you know.
It happened today, actually. A guy turned up in the IRC channel and he was trying to get support because when he was clicking on menu items, they weren't starting. And rather than try and diagnose what the problem was, and I was trying to help him diagnose, his question was, should I reinstall? You know, not should I try and debug the problem, should I try and figure out? Okay, he was frustrated and there was an issue right there that he couldn't get around. But the first reaction was reinstall, switch to another application, switch to a different distro, throw my computer away, try a different one. You know, it's all get rid of it, get something else.
It's a sledgehammer to crack a nut, really. It's the Windows way, really. If you break your computer that badly, at some point you end up reinstalling it.
The reinstalling is a very Windowsy mentality. I'm not sure about the switching applications.
It's an easy way to fix.
It's a lot.
I used to do it. You know, you break your distro trying to fix something or trying to change something. The easy thing to do is just to reinstall.
And reinstalling Ubuntu takes, what, half an hour?
Yeah.
It's not like Windows where you're there all day.
It's also depending on what your aim of doing it is. Because if I'm using a build of a product at work that I know is currently in development, if I hit some bugs, I'll raise them because I know that this is the process to get a better product out the door.
Mm. Yeah.
And usually I'm using it because I'm part of the development cycle. So that's in my frame of mind.
Yeah.
If I'm using Ubuntu, I'm not using it in order to test, rightly or wrongly. I'm using it to use it.
Yeah, no, that's actually
my purpose
exactly
is just to get done what I want to do. Yeah. I'm not in the frame of mind to start going, oh, is that a bug? Is that not a bug? And it's just complete change of conceptualizing what it is I'm doing. Mm. Whereas you do a lot of testing and stuff, so it's probably closer to you to think, oh, yeah, well, that's a bug, I'll raise it. And I can easily see, I mean, I do it at work on other products that I'm not working on that I just need as a dependency. And something doesn't work. And my first instinct is to go, oh, forget it. I'll just uninstall it and reinstall it and hope that makes it work. And then I get told off by someone else, so you'll come over and help me debug it and make it work. Mm. But it's just, to me, it's not worth that investment and effort.
I think
to make it work.
My point was less about the uninstall, reinstall type thing and more about switching apps.
Yeah.
Like going from throwing away Gwibber and using Pinot or throwing away Gwibber and using, you know, something else. And I actually sat there and went through three other Twitter clients and they all had issues. They all, you know, they were all broken in some way or another. I set myself a requirement that I didn't want a Twitter client that required Adobe Air. I wanted something that was native. And I tried four and they were all broken in some way or other. And I thought, well, why would I bother switching when this one's just as broken as all the others? I might as well stick with the one that we ship, file the bugs, and then at least next release, I've got a better chance of it actually being fixed.
I guess it depends if it's a showstopper or not for you, that particular functionality.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, luckily none of these were major catastrophes. I mean, some of them are quite annoying and frustrating, but, you know, I kind of put up with it.
But it comes back to support. Where do you, if you've got a problem with your application, where do you get support for it? There are so many places, and everywhere you go is something different. And it can get incredibly frustrating trying to fix your problem. Mm. Not necessarily finding bugs, but going to the forums or an IRC channel
or Google.
Or even knowing it is a bug.
Some people don't even bother doing that.
Yeah.
They don't even bother actively going and looking for help. This doesn't work. Throw it away, get a different thing.
Because life's too short.
Yeah.
For a lot of people it is. You know, well, as Laura said, I want it to just work.
If I already know that there's something else which does work and doesn't have the problem, then I'll use that instead. Because I know, you know, this will fix it, whereas filing a bug might get it fixed in a while, and there's some investment on my part to perhaps make a screencast, take some screenshots, explain what the problem is, and try and get somebody else to understand what I'm saying. Or I can just say, I know that works, I'll use that.
But each of the bugs I filed took no more than the amount of time it took me to explain it in a 60-second screencast. So it was press a button, start recording, select an area of the screen, do what I'm doing and talk while I'm doing it.
App to get installed, done.
Hit close.
Yeah, but the thing is, you're passionate about all of this, whereas people just want it to work.
I don't know how to create a screencast.
Just different people.
Right, I'll create a video telling you how. You know, that's the one screencast people ask me to make all the time, is can you make a screencast? How to make a screencast.
Metacast.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Seriously, that's the single most popular one.
I could probably work it out, but... Yeah.
But even, I'm not saying you have to do a video. It was just, it's something I thought would be a good way.
It's because a really good idea,
some of the stuff is animated on the screen, and you can't see that unless you take like loads of screenshots. Yeah, you know, it just doesn't work. But even if it's just a case, do you know how I actually filed the bug in Gribbr? I went to the help menu and said report a problem. That is what you do to file a bug. You go help, report a problem, and then you type, you bash your keyboard and tell them what the problem is. That's how you file a bug.
So would it be the same if somebody filed the bug and then used another client, in this case for a Twitter client or something?
If you switch to something else that works for you, brilliant. But at least tell the developers that the thing you were using is broken. Otherwise, in 6 months' time, bloody Gribbr's not fixed yet. Well, it won't be if you don't tell anyone that it's broken.
Mm.
I can't fathom how people can complain about something being broken, yet not actually tell the people who can fix it how it's broken.
It's the way.
I can relate to that a little bit, though, because I used to project films in cinemas and... nothing more irritating than at the end of the film, somebody comes out whinging that the sound isn't right, or there's a popping, or the picture's skewy on the screen. It's like, why didn't you tell somebody while I could actually fix it?
Yeah.
And it's that kind of...
Yeah, no.
You can't fix it if you don't know about it.
As a developer, no, I hit that problem all the time, but...
You've got to
as
know...
As a user, you don't want to offer in this case.
But you've got to know something new's fixing.
It's not my job. Someone else's job, this one. Oh, I'm not touching No, I'm not touching that.
But there's various things in Thunderbird that make me keep thinking I want to change to a better client. But I haven't taken the time to work out what it is those things are and what makes a better client. Mm. So I just kind of put up with it.
So you're going to suffer.
But it irritates me.
Yeah, there are things I suffer with as well.
But it's kind of, it's not hit that threshold of just being so annoying that I will move. In the meantime, I'll just put up with it. Yeah. And I have raised bugs against them before. It took forever to fix.
But putting up with them is one thing.
Yeah.
Ditching your old distro and going to something else.
Or just an application.
Or even an application. But yeah, the people who ditch the whole distro really kind of...
That's extreme.
It feels extreme to me because you get so used to the way a particular distro works and...
Many people don't. Packages. Many people flick, you know, distro as often as, you know, they change their underwear.
Really? Once or twice a month?
Yeah. As often as that.
But I guess,
as I said, as often as you change your underwear.
But I guess in that situation where you're changing your whole distro because you don't like the email client or the web browser or something, that's possibly because their concept of is the distro, and it's come with the distro, therefore it can go with the distro and I'll get another distro that's got a better one. So that makes kind of sense.
Just to be clear, I'm not saying that Ubuntu is the only distro and it's the best one and everyone should stick to it and you should never switch to any other distro in case anyone thinks, oh, Alan's saying that Ubuntu is perfect and you should file bugs and never switch distros.
You've got to put up with the buttons.
That's not what I'm saying.
You're talking about something specific.
Switching is fine. It's just, I just can't fathom why people go, well, that's broken, throw it away. You know, if it's broken, yeah, tell someone. You know, then this is where, you know, there are no analogies that this works with.
But it's not on cars.
But if there were, it would be, you know, anything. If anything in your house is broken, if your DVD player is broken and it's not a case of, like, the mains lead doesn't work, you take it to someone. Okay, car, whatever. It doesn't matter what it is. If something's broken, you take it to someone to fix it.
What if I've got a spare one on the shelf, which I know works?
What are you going to do with the broken one? Are you going to throw it away?
Yep.
Yeah.
These okay, days, fair enough. That's the tip. Yeah.
That's fine. But swapping it just because that one's broken and going out and actively getting another one without attempting to get that
fixed. This is something Alan feels passionately about.
It just seems a bit weird. It seems a bit alien.
It's the society that we live in. That's what we do. Throw away. Yeah. Especially with Linux, when you got so...
It's free.
Exactly. It's free.
That cost me so much.
I don't know. I think during the war, to be fair, nobody would have kept the software around if it was irritating.
And choice is inherent in what we do in open source. So one of the byproducts is we have got so many, in this case, Twitter clients, but so many choices of application, be it web browser, text editor, file manager, whatever, that it is so easy for somebody just to go, there's another text editor. Let's give that one a go. Oh, this one works, hasn't got these bugs. Oh,
it just seems selfish to me.
Oh, I agree with
you.
No, I agree with you. Yeah. But I think what I'm doing is pretty selfish, but at the same time,
Mark's
I want it to work.
It.
There's only so much time in the day.
Yeah, exactly.
Or space in your head or...
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, perhaps our listeners can email in and let us know what they do. Do they religiously file bugs, every bug that they come across? Or are they, that doesn't work, let's ditch it and try something else. Mm. And what do you think the right thing to do is? Send your emails in to podcast@ubuntu-uk.org.
It's time for the Gerald Ecosphere.
No, it's the bit about Ubuntu.
That's the one. And Canonical have released a case study covering the French National Police Force's move from Microsoft-based IT infrastructure to open-source solutions, beginning by switching Microsoft Office to OpenOffice.org and Internet Explorer to Firefox. The force has now switched 85,000 PCs from Windows to Ubuntu. The study claims the switch has saved the force €2 million in license fees to date. The switch is expected to be complete by 2015.
So do we think in a couple of years' time we're going to see another video on YouTube with quotes from the French police force about how OpenOffice didn't work for them?
Let's hope not.
Yes.
Yeah, it wasn't so long ago that was it the British police forces that had moved to it decided to chuck it all out and buy a load of Microsoft licenses.
Oh, really?
Mm. Yeah.
Whilst they've saved €2 million in license fees, I wonder how much more they're paying in support. And how many people had to train to support at various places?
Wondered that.
You've been believing that YouTube
video.
No.
It's just a real consideration, isn't it?
I mean, it's a case study from Canonical saying, look how good Canonical stuff is. So I'm skeptical to begin with, I'm afraid.
I think it's great news.
How much training do you need to use OpenOffice and Firefox?
Yeah, but you can't.
I can't find the. No. How to make tables?
Yeah,
I can't do this.
But I mean, I bet they were never trained to use Internet Explorer. Really, most people aren't in the first place. Just expected to learn it, and then you've got an IT department who could hopefully work it out for themselves in order to support their own team. So it's no different from before.
IT departments, no faith.
Well, no, but they've had to do it once. They can do it again.
Mm.
A group of schools in Hampshire are blogging about using Ubuntu in education for the month of November.
Yes, something that Alan Lord of the Allens has let us know about, not directly, but there's a project called www.ubuntu.onemonthof.org, not the easiest URL to say. But yes, through the Open Source Schools website, he's let us know about that. Our plan is to spend the whole of November working with Ubuntu and looking at what works and what doesn't for UK schools. And there's a blog, which is the website I mentioned before, where they're going to post their findings.
So is that students or is that staff?
I think it's both. Okay. I think it's actually how you could use it in the classroom as well as how you could use it for administrative purposes.
Because my kids use it at university and college, and they do have a few issues, but nothing spectacular.
The issues I read on the latest post were along the lines of, I couldn't get Spotify to work and I couldn't play games. I wonder which bit of the classroom they were using that.
That's got to be the teachers in the staff room, surely.
John O'Bacon has written a blog post clarifying the switch to Unity in 11.04, and a commenter on there has invoked Shuttleworth's law.
They've invoked it, or they've said they will leave?
Oh, sorry.
I didn't read it.
just for anyone who didn't listen last time, we decided that Shuttleworth's law is when a bug report or a blog post, the conversation results in someone throwing their toys out the pram and deciding they're going to leave the project. Is that right?
Yes. If this isn't fixed, I'm leaving Ubuntu.
That's right.
Or if this happened,
and Jono's post does go into some detail about all the points that everyone keeps saying, like that it's a fork and that what about if I still want to run GNOME and what about accessibility and all the other points that, you know, pretty much everyone has raised about Unity.
I guess it's a pretty good fact if you've got questions about the Unity move. So, yeah, worth checking out.
Mark Shuttleworth has blogged about plans to run Unity on the Wayland display server instead of X.
Okay, so for people who don't know what Wayland is...
I think there was a mass Google for Wayland on the day when
that's what Mark, I did last night.
Mark posted that, yeah.
Okay, Wayland is...
It's a display server, like X is a display server, which has compositing built into it.
Okay.
And as I understand, the main difference between it and X is that it basically expects the application to do all the sort of rendering of what's going to be displayed.
So is it a drop-in replacement for X?
I think it is in some cases. If you're using, as I understand it, I'm not an expert on this, by the way.
You're the expert in the
But you read the FAQ.
As I understand it, if, for instance, OpenGL is rendering all of your windows for you, as it does if you've got a 3D accelerated desktop, then essentially Wayland will sort of accept that and display it. But things like other things will be able to be modified to use it. Like apparently Cairo could be modified to speak in a way that Wayland understands. But at the moment, it's not ready to be a drop-in replacement for anything.
Okay.
What's the motivation for this? Why would we be wanting sometime in the future to switch from X to Wayland?
Apparently it's lighter weight.
And do we care?
Why would you switch from Apache to Lighty?
Lighter weight. Yes, I care about that.
Hoist on your own baton. I think you should bring back X386. That was, did a good enough job, didn't it?
X386 is still there.
Yeah.
Their list of projects that use it is quite small.
Smaller now, is it? Right, okay. Spread Ubuntu, a Spread Firefox Star grassroots marketing campaign, has been launched.
Technically, it launched a very long time ago, but it was hanging off a domain that nobody could remember. So, where's that Spread Ubuntu thing? And everyone had to Google it, whereas now it's actually spreadubuntu.org.
And there's a .com as well?
Yeah, both. So, and I think Canonical had the domains, and there was lots of faff to try and get the site, so that it was all ready for, production ready.
And it looks very nice. It's obviously themed with the new Ubuntu styling.
Yeah, it looks really good. Yeah. So the idea is if you want to create some materials, you can go and download some materials that other people have already created, like leaflets or posters or logos and all kinds of stuff. And you can download it and reuse it and obviously share whatever materials you've created for whatever events you've done.
There's quite a few languages are supported as well, it seems.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is if you upload it in an open format that other people can edit, like SVG for graphics or an open office document, then other people could take that, translate it, and reuse it and remix it.
So should people get involved and contribute there?
Totally. If you've ever run an Ubuntu event, just upload your posters or whatever content you've created, because other people could use that as a starting point. Not everyone is, able to do great artistry or is great with prose, and so taking someone else's work and building on it, well, it's the open source way, isn't it?
The Ubuntu Manual Project has decided to release less often and focus solely on English for release to ease strain on the contributors.
How big a contributor team have they got?
I think it's kind of reduced a bit since the big push for the first release of the manual. And some of the contributors have been busy with real-life stuff, school and work and whatever.
Yeah.
But I think it was pretty ambitious.
I was going to say it was always hugely ambitious, because their goals were to have it done in every language that Ubuntu is done in, and to have it done sort of on the day of release for that release, and to have it totally bug-free
with screenshots.
With screenshots, translated in different languages. So, it was a massive undertaking, and they did really well to get the first one out.
Yes.
But every subsequent release has fallen, behind. There hasn't been a Maverick one yet. And we're, over a month past the release of Maverick. Well, we will be by the time this podcast comes out. And that's just down to time and, motivation and stuff. Mm. And one of the problems is that I think they get demotivated by new features being dropped into Ubuntu at the last minute.
Right.
And because the development of Ubuntu works in such a way that it's really never finished until the last day, and they've got to write their documentation and take a load of screenshots, thousands of screenshots, in the last few days before the release to get it ready. And it's just not practical.
It's almost something that that can't be a sort of community-based thing. This is almost something that's got to be driven by and paid for by Canonical to keep it up to date and, you know, released at the same time as the release rather than...
I don't know.
A company couldn't do it.
I think it is possible to do this, but you need a vast number of people contributing together, and they need the Canonical need the discipline of not dropping stuff in at the last minute.
But, I mean, that's the benefit of the way they work, is that they can drop things in at the last minute and get it right up until the end.
Yeah.
You know what they need?
Dexy.
We do all their screenshots and stuff for them.
Yeah.
Well, they actually have a screenshot tool. Okay. They actually have a tool called QuickShot that they developed,
right,
where you boot and it generates the screenshots and uploads them to their server. It does everything all like pretty semi-automatically. It's pretty amazing. And they did all that for the first release. So it's an amazing amount of work that they have done, and it's to be commended. But, you know, it would be a bit of a shame to let it... you know, fall by the wayside, or the translations not get done.
I think the big problem is the lag. You've always got to have some lag behind the development to the English version, and some lag behind the English to each to the translations. Mm. And no matter how many people you've got, you can't get rid of that lag.
Mm. I wonder if they're trying to gather any stats on whether or not it is in fact being used. Because after all this effort, I wonder if anybody's actually downloading it and using it. Because if they're not, then maybe...
Well, they know how many people download it, but you can never... Just like with our podcast, we know how many people download it. No idea how many people listen.
It's probably like 10 times that, you know, they're all in
groups. I
thought
you were going to say it's probably 10 people.
No. Each person who downloads it has like 10 people around listening.
Who knows?
Yeah.
It's plausible.
The other problem they have is that as soon as it's ready, there's a new release 6 months later, and things change. And, like, you know, in the last two releases, we've had things like the button move, which threw them because that was on their release and they had to redo loads of screenshots. Yeah. And now this time we've got the font, which was dropped in fairly late. And now next time it's going to be Unity. So every time, because we're so fast moving and dropping new stuff in all the time, they get stung with this every single time. So the other question is, do they just stick to doing LTS releases?
I was going to suggest that exact thing.
Yeah, I got in there before you.
And if they hooked up with Dexy, then every time they rebuilt the, I think it's XML source they use, isn't it? So every time they rebuilt that, it would automatic, and it would hook into the Ubuntu build and would automatically pull into the dock.
Lovely.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be a case of, oh, we have to redo our screenshots. They would be redone before you realised you needed to do them.
That would be rather cool. Alison Randall has written a summary of the achievements and discussions that happened at the recent UDS.
Yes, quite a long list, by the look of it.
Yes, too long, did not read.
Well, what were the big hitters?
LibreOffice is going to replace OpenOffice.org.
That's not really surprising, is it?
Not really, no. Well, they could have stuck with the Oracle version.
Banshee is the new music player.
That is a bit more interesting.
Did they actually say it was, or did they say it was going to be if they could pare it down enough?
Banshee will be the default music player, is what it says here.
Well, I use KDE, so I don't mind.
I saw, George Castro did a really nice screencast of how he uses Banshee, and there's some features in Banshee that I was completely unaware of, about how it it can automatically create a playlist for you based on which tracks you play most often. And he also has one where he wants to play tracks that undiscovered favourites, where it's tracks that he's played 5 times or more, but not in the last couple of months or something.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is really quite cool. Yeah. I didn't even know it was possible to do that kind of stuff. So, yeah, there's some good compelling reasons for using something like Banshee.
I saw Stuart Langridge tweeting today. He's worrying that what happens if I'm listening to a track I really like and I get a phone call and I pause the track, does Banshee think I don't like the track very much because I pause it? Or if I like it a lot but I choose not to listen to it right now because I'm not in the mood for that particular song, does it mean that I won't hear it so often later? And
well, the other thing it has favorite thing like the stars, and George in his video said, I don't actually use the stars. I don't use it. I let it do its own intelligence. So I think you can coerce it a bit. So yeah, Banshee, good.
It's all right, Stuart. You can sleep again.
And Ubuntu Netbook Edition will be on the same CD as the desktop.
Yes.
One CD.
Wow,
like Kubuntu. Wow. One CD to rule them all.
Does Kubuntu have the netbook? It said netbook edition on the same CD as Kubuntu.
Yes, because it's all. Basically, it just has different Plasma containers, which are the way it displays widgets on the screen.
The last thing that I caught my eye from the UDSN write-up, were being a bit of a media geek, is work on colour management, which is good for photographers and anybody doing graphic design and stuff, and more work on multi-monitor support. I'm not quite sure what that would involve, because I think it's pretty good at the moment.
Well, Unity, it's broken. At the moment in Unity, it's wildly broken. I mean, if you've got two screens, we've got a single menu on the top of one of the screens. So if you've got a window in the bottom right-hand corner of your right-hand screen, the menu for it is in the top left-hand corner of the left-hand screen.
Another reason not to use Unity.
Yeah. Or you should just use one screen. Actually, one of the biggest things that's probably interesting, I thought I'd mention, is Software Center is adding a feature to allow you to donate free software projects. So being able push, throw your money at the software that you use, rather than only having, software that you pay for.
So in the app, there'll be a thing saying...
I have no idea how it's going to be implemented.
It's going to be using Ubuntu Bank.
Ubuntu Pay.
Ubuntu Money.
Your Ubu dollars.
The Free Culture Showcase has decided to theme entries for Ubuntu 11.04 around a particular benefit of using Ubuntu and free software.
Do we know what the theme is yet?
I don't think they've decided yet. Okay. There's a schedule for announcing the theme and then collecting entries based on that theme, but I don't think there's a theme yet.
Oh, okay. So January announcement, contest open, February contest closed, March shortlist complete, and then end of March judging complete.
Yes. So I wonder if that's going to make it easier for arty types to contribute. Because it gives them a bit of direction, doesn't it? Rather than...
They don't like pressure, though, do they?
No, but they like direction sometimes. Okay. Somewhere to think.
Help channel your creativity.
Indeed.
Yeah. And one of the guys has created a little video to introduce it, to introduce the Free Culture Showcase, and he made it all with free software.
Wow, that's cool.
Is there anything else?
The design team also had a video that featured at UDS, and it's interesting that the video for Free Culture Showcase... They've said, this was made with Blender on Ubuntu and, all using free software. And the one that was shown at UDS, which apparently was taken from a conference where they were trying to attract business decision makers to their stand, was posted on the design blog. And a few people have asked the question, can we have the source for this? Because we'd like to remix it and, make it. And so far that hasn't been put forward, probably because it wasn't made on Ubuntu.
And that's... That's all the in the Gerald bit about Ubuntu this time. It's time for your feedback, and first up, Martin van der Streek gave us some feedback about a recent command line love.
Yeah, Martin pinged me on IRC and he says he's found a blog post that's a better colour for man pages. We did the command line love using most to get colour man pages.
That's right, yes.
And he's pointed us to one that uses less, and it doesn't require the addition of the most package.
Because less is on there generally.
Yeah, it's already on there. Yeah.
So, as you might imagine, after the last episode, we got some feedback about Unity. James Starling emailed in.
I despise the Unity desktop environment. I believe it's a huge mistake for both netbooks and as the default for Ubuntu 11.04. Because it runs very poorly on netbooks that lack graphical acceleration. It's not an efficient interface. For instance, try moving files from one folder to another or starting a second copy of Firefox. People don't like change. I predict multiple monitors will be a fail, and the global menu is only global sometimes, and of the three of you from the podcast, none of you liked it or used it. I suggest that means something.
There's actually five of us, and there were
the views of this podcast do not represent...
Well, quite.
Other podcasts are available.
Well, only Simon said he didn't like it, I think.
I haven't. I've barely used it.
I said I didn't like
it. You said you didn't like it and you therefore don't use it. Simon thought it was a bad idea.
Yeah, I still do.
Tony just uses a netbook.
Yeah, I haven't used Unity, so I can't speak from a position of
I installed it on my Toshiba laptop, so it's not a netbook. It's a full-size laptop.
How was it?
And I don't know. I'm kind of ambivalent about it, really.
I don't use a netbook.
I'm not so sure that people don't like change is a valid reason not to change. We would still be in, caves, I think.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the Dark Ages then. No,
I was going, for
going
that
further
one.
Back. Than that.
Yeah, I'll
we'd
go,
still so be fish.
Taking it back old school. We'd be soup.
Soren Salagi gets stuck in and even invokes Shuttleworth's law.
Okay, so Unity, I hate it. It doesn't look bad, but I really don't like macOS, so I'm not going to like Unity either. Plus, the universal menus, or whatever they call it, is crap.
Oh, dear.
Wasn't that different? Huh? Weren't you talking about a side panel that does something rather than the Mac top panel?
It's both. It's both. So Unity has the thing down the side that has icons on it, and it has a menu along the top.
Except it only has the menu when you're using a GNOME application, doesn't it? So, for instance, probably. Firefox, it doesn't. Because KDE used to do it on KDE 3, but only with KDE apps.
Right.
Okay, can I restate my preference now, then?
What?
I hate that menu in Macs. I really hate it.
Okay, I hear a lot of people say that, but I never hear people say
Because you accidentally click somewhere else and the whole menu changes, but you don't realise the focus has changed. So then you go up and click a menu and it's for the wrong program.
I
used to use
like
a Mac at work, and it drove me absolutely nuts.
One thing that is flawed with this is if you have Focus Follows Mouse. So, like you said, accidentally clicking on a
that
on a
would
window,
be worse. Yeah,
it'd be worse as you move the mouse over window. The boom, menu. Boom, boom,
that's another. Why would you do that?
Well, Focus Follows Mouse. Anyone who doesn't have Focus Follows Mouse is an idiot.
Yeah, I say that right now.
You are wrong.
I never had Focus Follows Mouse until very recently. I switched to it, and I find it really useful.
Yeah, see,
it is the right way. It's the one true way.
The Mac menu is
Anyway, Sorin continues. But the most disappointing part of everything that happened lately is Canonical and their way of doing things. I mean, Mark is investing his own money in Ubuntu so he can do what he wants. But I seem to remember when it all started out that the plan was for the entire thing to be managed by the community. If that is no longer the case, then it should be made clear so people know what to expect. To me, it seems like Canonical is slowly becoming the Apple of the open source space. And I do hope Ubuntu will bring more users to Linux. But the way things are going, I'll have to look at another distro.
Hey, and there it is.
The clue, I think, is the fact that the community doesn't have a Canonical manager. Canonical have a community manager. That's the way around it was. It wasn't all negative, though. Martin Gustafsson in Sweden says, I think the introduction of Unity for the Natty desktop is an interesting step that cannot be discarded without trying. After the first lessons learned with Unity on netbooks, if there is a problem with adapting the known shell, I think it's quite a natural move to try and adapt and further develop Unity for the desktop edition. Will the community have its say? Of course. The introduction of Unity for desktops has only been announced, and it hasn't yet appeared in a beta release or similar. Furthermore, criticism from users regarding Unity on netbooks must be valuable feedback for the developers of Unity. I do not think anyone should jump to conclusions before the 1204 LTS.
Yeah, I do kind of agree.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think 1204 should be absolutely fantastic. The thing is, nobody has actually seen
the Unity that's going to be in 1104. It's still being developed. One of the guys in the Ubuntu UK IRC channel is one of the developers, and he's working on it. And they haven't actually released any code yet. So loads of people are pronouncing that they're going to leave Ubuntu when they haven't even seen the product.
Only 16 months to go.
What, till 1204? We need a countdown timer on our website.
And Richard Zabada Marsh thought of us when he saw the designer Toy Store's webpage of vinyl platform toys based on the Linux mascot Tux and designed by a variety of talented artists from all over the world. And we'll put a link to it in the show notes.
They are pretty.
They are frankly disturbing.
Okay, I meant disturbing.
They're pretty disturbing.
Thanks, Tony.
Yes, lots of randomly decorated Tuxes. And that wraps up your feedback.
Right, told you it was going to be a feisty one. That's the end. You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, including our voicemail numbers and Twitter feeds, Facebook and IRC channels. Let us know what you think of the show and give us your thoughts about Ubuntu and the community around it.
Yes, and for the no people who've asked, although this is the 20th episode of the season, we're not finishing at this point. We're carrying on for a few more.
Yeah, for the hundreds of people who called in and left us messages.
Our email box has been deluged with
spam, literally spam. Email.
We're carrying on up until Christmas for a little while yet. So not for the last episode, even though all our previous seasons have been 20. So yeah, we'll see you in two weeks' time. Thank you for listening.
Bye-bye.
Bye.